Chapter 9. Caduceus and Kundalini. A week after meeting Baba, I became aware of a message hidden within a familiar symbol, the caduceus, symbol of medicine. A latent but extremely powerful energy called Kundalini, or serpent fire, is thought to lie sleeping within the body, a hidden potential of which most people are completely unaware their entire lives. The principle of Kundalini is significant in Hinduism, yoga, and virtually all mystical and occult doctrines. The caduceus symbolizes the manner in which this energy is awakened. When I discovered this, I realized that it might provide answers to many of my questions. Consider for a moment the symbol of the caduceus. It is a staff around which two snakes are entwined, intersecting each other at several points. At the top of the staff is a pair of wings. Charles W. Leadbeater, a noted scholar of occult and mystical literature, has theorized that the caduceus represents an ancient secret of the means of achieving transcendence of the body and ego. The staff, he believes, is a representation of the spinal cord, and the two snakes symbolize paths that the Kundalini takes as it awakens and unfolds from its source at the base of the spine. The path beginning to the left is called Ida in Sanskrit, and the one to the right, Pingala. The pathway through the center of the spine to the head is Sushumna. It is thought that by the disciplined practice of meditation, chanting, or specific yogic exercises, usually over a period of several years, an individual can liberate his sleeping Kundalini. As Kundalini energy awakens and evolves, certain areas along the spine called chakras also awaken or open up to become centers of organized energy systems. As this energy is developed, the individual's consciousness changes. How he perceives the world, and thus how he reacts to it, changes. My experience with bioenergetic therapy made me more open-minded to such a concept than I would otherwise have been, and gave me an awareness of how such a transformation might take place. I was beginning to experience strange new vibrations and perceptions myself. Also, I began to come across increasing discussion of this type of energy. Dr. William Tiller, for example, a noted Stanford University physicist, includes the chakras in his scientific model of how the human body evolves in response to the radiation of energy and information from the environment. And in Breakthrough to Creativity, Shafika Karagula, a Los Angeles neuropsychiatrist, describes in fascinating detail the chakras as seen by sensitives with whom she is working, people with highly developed sensory or extrasensory powers. There are supposedly seven chakras located not in the physical body, but in the etheric body, thought to exist coincident with its physical counterpart. Dr. Tiller refers to the etheric body as the, quote, negative space-time frame body, end quote, and sees each of the bodies as acting as a, quote, tuned circuit via which one may tap energy from the cosmos or communicate with another aspect of self, end quote. The chakras are thought to be intimately related to the body's endocrine system. With the successive awakening of each, there are said to be corresponding changes in one's body, emotions, mind, and degree of consciousness. The progressive expansion of consciousness yields an increase of knowledge about oneself and a deepening awareness regarding one's relationship to the cosmos. Finally, when the seventh or crown chakra at the top of the head is awakened and opened, the individual is supposedly able to leave his physical body thus realizing the soul's transcendence of the body. Coming to realize fully that the nature of one's fundamental identity is conscious energy or awareness rather than body, ego, or personality is thought to be the highest human level of knowledge. And actually rising from the normal level of consciousness to this higher level is represented, of course, by the wings of the caduceus. What is the relationship of all this to psychiatry? The first and second chakras, supposedly related to the adrenal glands and gonads of the endocrine gland system, are said to be located in connections with the anal and genital areas of the pelvis. This seems automatically to parallel Freud's observation of the importance of these body areas in developing personality. These two chakras appear to be related to coarser, more basic energies, such as aggression and hostility, or what Freud called anal attitudes, and to genital or sexual attitudes. According to the theory of Kundalini, when chakras are awakened, the personality takes on certain psychological qualities which reflect the chakra's corresponding energies. And in fact, many of psychiatry's personality types and its description of orientations to life are related to anal and genital characteristics in different combinations and intensities. Most of us are aware of these basic energies, and part of our life's work is to be in touch with them so as to channel them appropriately for our survival. As a matter of fact, the first chakra is often called the root chakra. There are, however, some people who are not in touch with these fundamental biological or survival energies, as if these chakras have not been awakened in them. These people have not experienced aggressiveness or sexuality in their lives. They are, in fact, almost void of any way of making contact with the world. Psychiatrists, it seems to me, should be concerned with helping people first to get in touch with these lower energies, and then with finding ways of channeling them for better adaptation, adjustment, and happiness in life. For the most part, however, psychiatrists make the mistake of awakening these energies without dealing with their proper channeling and disciplining. Then we get into some of the difficulties of our age, like letting it all hang out and worshipping the emotions and drive systems at the expense of learning discipline and control. I've already discussed the kind of trap into which this can lead us, and we can observe in our culture some of the destructive aftermath of this attitude. In the yogic system, on the other hand, much weight is given to the proper disciplining and channeling of these lower energies. After becoming aware of aggression and sexuality, one is taught detachment from them so that he can then focus on the awakening of higher chakral areas. Yogis, in fact, when they have attained a certain level of development, generally practice sexual abstinence, together with control of thoughts and emotions, not allowing anger or bad thoughts. This, as I have said, is generally considered repressive by most psychiatrists. So much for the first and second chakras. The third chakra is supposedly located in the abdominal area and related to the pancreas. The fourth in the chest near the heart, related to the thymus gland. The fifth in the neck by the thyroid gland. The sixth on the brow between the eyes, in the area of the so-called third eye, pituitary gland. And the seventh on the crown of the head, pineal gland. When each of these areas is awakened, one achieves a new level of consciousness and experiences the world differently. The heart chakra, for instance, is associated with the capacity for selfless love. when the brow chakra, or third eye, is activated, one might experience clairvoyance and telepathic phenomena. And when the crown chakra is awakened, the ability to leave the body and experience oneself as pure awareness or consciousness. The yogic powers awakened during this upward journey can represent drawbacks and obstacles to be overcome if they tend to draw the spiritual aspirant into the attachment to the powers themselves and cause him to lose sight of the primary goal, union with the higher self. This is the same danger which lies in our attachment to such coarser energies as aggression, assertiveness, and sensuality. We can get caught up and worship the power in these energies and never grow any further. If the caduceus and the theories related to it might indeed reflect reality, it is no wonder that I found the theories and practices of psychiatry very short-sighted in their vision of man's place in the cosmos. For after awakening to the low energies of aggression and sexuality, the subject matter of most psychotherapies, the journey has just begun. There is a whole world of evolution ahead. In this regard, Sai Baba's teachings of how to pattern our social lives took on greater meaning. Such attitudes as responsibility, discipline, work, duty, devotion, dedication, right action, and surrender are important not only for proper conduct among people, but most especially for developing the necessary internal discipline in oneself to handle higher energies when they are awakened. According to all religious systems, these attitudes are absolutely essential for the growth of the self and the stability of world society. And in contrast, how chaotic individuals and societies become without them. Even though the religious frame of reference seems old-fashioned and square in relation to our contemporary Western system of values, it began to appear to me to be exactly what is needed in the world, as if no one had ever said that before. It became clear that chaos is what develops when we lose sight of the higher reality most people call God and place in its stead mind, emotion, and the material world. The system represented by the caduceus and the systems expressed in most religions then appear to structure our energies, defining priorities and projecting attitudes from a grander perspective than that afforded by the routines and demands of our everyday material lives. But what is lacking in modern culture is a conviction that these religious systems actually represent reality or truth. Religion, it seems, has fallen into such ill repute. What great experience can bring us back to realization of the eternal truths embodied in the religions of the world and the resolve to lead righteous lives? What kind of monumental occurrence is required? Chapter 10, A Soul in Transformation. If the caduceus symbol representing the dynamics of Kundalini energy does in fact reflect a deeper vision of reality, it offers us an overview with which to understand Western psychiatry's relationship to spirituality and gives us a great deal of knowledge about the nature of the path Godward. There are specific pronouncements on how to lead one's life, specific descriptions of guideposts we will pass along the way, and comments about the pitfalls and dangers to be encountered. The biggest question at this point appears to be, does this system actually exist? Is it a true expression of the path? It seems to me that the crucial factor in answering this question for most of us, wrapped up as we are in our scientific, technological-minded culture, is direct, concrete proof and not abstract ideas. The strongest argument for most is experience that can be perceived and measured by the senses. In this regard, the Russians seem to be way ahead of us. The book, Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain, by Sheila Ostrander and Lynn Schroeder, reports that Russian scientists have experimented with and are now capable of scientifically evaluating such so-called psychic or paranormal phenomena as telepathy, clairvoyance, psychokinesis, psychic healing, and the nature of auras. We, in this country, have awakened more recently to the possible validity of these phenomena. We're becoming fascinated by them, and at the same time, we're trying to find a system of explanation which will allow us to understand them better. Uri Geller, who has been studied by scientists at the Stanford Research Institute, appears on the basis of considerable test data accumulated to possess certain psychic powers or CDs. He has been remarkably accurate, for example, in reproducing drawings seemingly communicated to him telepathically by test subjects. And it would appear that he may be able to bend metal objects at a distance by willpower alone, although this is disputed in some quarters. Edgar Cayce developed a great reputation for seemingly being able to gather information at a distance, telepathically or clairvoyantly, and then offering medically sophisticated programs of healing for people he had never even met. His apparent success with these healing powers received impressive documentation. Psychics, such as Geller and Cayce, seem able to perceive things beyond the range of the senses. They often relate similar experiences concerning their powers, and many have come to similar conclusions about them. Most feel there is a higher order of reality than that of which we are usually aware, and that for some reason beyond their consciousness, they are being used as channels between it and the world with which we are familiar. Catherine Kuhlman, the late well-known minister of a church in which many miraculous healings have apparently taken place, also saw herself in this relationship to a higher reality, stating that she could absolutely feel the presence of the Holy Spirit. She could stand in front of thousands in her congregation and point to areas in the auditorium, making such specific statements as, quote, "There is a gentleman with long-standing cancer in his hip who has just been cured. There is a person with a broken ankle in that part of the auditorium who is now being cured and relieved of pain. There is someone over there who has been in a wheelchair for a number of years and is now cured and can get up. Will these people get up and come to the front of the auditorium?" End quote. And in an amazing and emotion-filled demonstration of some kind of extraordinary force at work, these people would rise and move forward. It's beyond the scope of this book to do more than point out such well-known examples of evidence pointing to the existence of paranormal powers in the possession of individuals claiming to have made contact with a higher reality. But the reader must be aware of the wealth of material available on this subject. Much of it, of course, is absurd, sensationalistic, and exploitational. A great deal of the literature, however, is compelling an eloquent documentation of dimensions of being beyond the physical world. In the history of man, there have been certain rare, supposedly divine figures capable of demonstrating extraordinary powers in a most concrete manner, who have said not only they knew of such a higher reality, but that, in fact, they were this reality, thus indicating that they had gone completely beyond duality and merged into the oneness of the universe. All of the concepts with which this book is concerned, the question of the reality beyond the caduceus, the limits of man's potential, the purpose of life, the reality of God and the nature of the path to Him, all the deepest, most profound questions that lie at the center of our existence and to which we yearn for answers so that we may adjust our lives accordingly toward truth, all these questions are answered by the appearance of such magnificent beings. Their appearances on earth have had monumental impact on humanity. They are humanity's brightest moment. They demonstrate by the very nature, quality, and rhythm of their lives the reality of higher dimensions, the awe-inspiring mystery of that something beyond, and by the miracle of their love and encouragement, they give faith, strength, and direction to our lives, creating in many the bliss and love which come from contact with the divine. Only a handful of such divine figures are well known to the world today. Among them, the legendary Rama and Krishna in the Hindu tradition, Buddha, and Jesus Christ. In this book, I propose to introduce you to another, Satya Sai Baba, who is, in my opinion, the brightest, clearest living proof of a higher reality, embodying concrete evidence which can be observed and measured. He himself has said that we are indeed uniquely fortunate as no other avatar, incarnation of God or the Spirit of God, has moved so freely and openly amongst the people, allowing all to see and experience the grandeur which he embodies. He asks people to come, measure him, sound him out, investigate him, and then draw their own conclusions. Of all the emotional, psychological, and social reactions and phenomena I have observed, all the experiences I have had, none has equaled the mystery and magnificence of my experience of Sai Baba. He has taught me that the deepest, most profound, innate drive and yearning in us is not aggression or dominance or sexuality. It is merging, returning home to God. Sai Baba has shown me where and why other psychological theories I have followed are short-sighted and limited when they fail to recognize the reality of God and the spiritual dimension. He has shown me how to continue in spite of all obstacles along the spiritual path. I feel that he is a teacher so profound and deep that no words or concepts can categorize him. He is beyond definition and boundary. Bangalore, 8 a.m., May 22, 1972. Dear Sharon, there is no doubt in my mind that Sai Baba is divine. I astound myself to say such a thing. What must I have experienced, a rational, scientific man, to say such a thing? I believe I can't even communicate the experience. I know all this isn't hypnosis, mass delusion, hallucination, hysteria, an effect of cultural shock or drug intoxication. It's too simple to say, I saw a materialization, and then all of a sudden changed. I marvel at the experience, unable to relate it fully, joyful that I'm able to share it with so many people who are also witnessing it. I believe Sai Baba to be an incarnation of God. It appears to me now that all those stories in Hindu, Christian, and Hebrew literature are not symbolic. There really is a spiritual level of reality that can make itself manifest. One of the most amazing insights I've had has been experiencing how dramatically one can change upon seeing this higher reality. It's like a person jumping from one level of consciousness to another. Everything seems different. When I speak to people devoted to Baba, I can feel now a certain subtle vibration between us, which tells us that we have become aware of a new reality. And when talking to those who are not devotees, it is plain that they simply don't perceive or understand certain nuances of meaning and expression used by devotees. I can't describe more clearly what happens during this sudden change, only that I can see my life powerfully affected with this experience and vision of a new reality coloring everything I see. If I am strong enough to continue to comprehend the significance of all this, I know that I will be profoundly changed. I now plainly see that there are moral and spiritual laws governing our existence, laws for us to follow, perhaps even more real than scientific laws. Followed, they will lead us closer to ultimate truth, bliss, and meaning. And if unheeded to pain, meaninglessness, and suffering. How strange it is for me to do so thoroughly believe in a higher reality, a higher level of things, when just a few days ago, I was such a doubter and skeptic. Yesterday, I experienced more miracles. It's as if Baba is allowing me now to see this wonderful power close up. I saw a ring created right in front of my eyes for a visiting professor, also much for Bhuti. I have met many, many people who have told me of Baba's uncanny knowledge of their innermost secrets. He will approach people in the ashram who are discussing matters and add instant insight and direction to their conversation without having been physically present earlier to know what they were talking about. I mean, in short, that I am witnessing in live color and in the flesh an experience a million times more astonishing than the fairy tale stories I have been telling my four sweet children. In fact, now I believe that these stories about witches and angels, monsters and gods probably refer to a dimension of being more real than the physical world we consider real life. I am aware now that there really are such things as black magic and evil, angels and gods. I feel blessed to be here to experience such a phenomenon. I am feeling more of Baba's love and protection. My feelings of a few days ago of apprehension and worry on witnessing such power are quieting. Baba appears all-loving. He is everywhere, giving to everyone with ending energy. I don't see how a human being can perform the tasks that he does with so much energy. His smile is electrifying, and he can change from a child to a lion in the wink of an eye. After witnessing his powers and seeing materializations firsthand, I am convinced that the hundreds of stories I have heard about him are true. I see my task in the near future as having to come to terms with certain elements in my life to align myself more fully with Baba. His teachings are clear. He is showing the way. He preaches constant meditation and contact with God, devoting oneself to godly pursuits and a righteous way of life, not allowing bad thoughts or actions, controlling and detaching from emotions, canalizing one's passions. Discipline, discipline, transcending the level of bodily pleasures. Don't waste a second of precious time. Remember your spiritual goal. Work hard. Devote yourself to God. Seek wisdom. I struggled terribly against what I thought to be a Puritan moralism. Yet after witnessing Baba's greatness, I can do nothing but accept fully what he says. He is truly so magnificent. The time is drawing closer for my return home, and I am excited by the thought of seeing you soon. With all my love, Sam. 6:30 a.m., May 24th. Dearest love, I had a very hard and painful day yesterday. Became very ill with a temperature of 103.6 and aching all over, diarrhea and abdominal cramping. I was dazed and very uncomfortable. Although, as you know, I'm usually very frightened in this situation, I was amazingly peaceful, even though suffering a great deal. I had a feeling of being protected by Baba. He came up to me personally, felt my pulse, and said that I would be all right. I cried after this, feeling that he cared enough to approach me. This morning, I feel much better. I used to be embarrassed by allowing myself to feel dependent, but I am convinced now that this sort of dependency is realistic, as man is, in fact, very fragile and vulnerable and yearns to make contact with his Father and move into a higher reality. In fact, I think this is probably man's most basic instinct and represents his true life's work. The lectures here lately have been a bit better. One was about Sri Aurobindo. He is considered a saint who at one time in his life was jailed and locked in solitary confinement because of his activities in resisting English rule. After a short while, he broke into another level of consciousness and held a conversation for 14 days with a late great yogi, Swami Vivekananda, who taught him deeper principles in the practice of yoga. After his release, he wrote about what he had learned from his contact with this higher dimension and brought renewed light and life to spirituality. Following his release from prison, he started an ashram and lived 40 years in a single room without ever leaving it. Imagine that. Only a madman or the divine could do something like that. He is considered a scientist of consciousness who evidently found everything in inner space and needed to spend no time in the world we consider outer space except to conquer it. This type of approach to learning is deeply fascinating to me. In contrast to the West's emphasis on cerebration and the acquiring of intellectual knowledge, a yogi might hang from a tree by one arm for 10 years and learn all there is to know by that technique. Strange but true. This cosmic organization of things, this interlayering of realities, continues to electrify and excite me. It is absolutely amazing to me that we as humans can break out of our familiar reality. People here call this illusion, and ascend to a greater consciousness in which we are actually in touch with great spirits of the past or future. I have read about higher levels of consciousness, and I'm witnessing daily concrete proof of the existence of them and the qualities one can develop as he evolves higher and higher. Evidently, man has to cast aside his attachment to the material and sensual life and strive toward the spiritual. Baba has stated that his purpose is to bring the righteous life back to people and back to the world. He says that he will not fail. It is clear that my job is to change myself and become a spiritual man. Love, Sam. 8 a.m., May 25th. Dearest Sharon and family, I'm learning new things each day. Yesterday, Dr. S. Bhagavantam, a very well-known nuclear physicist with an international reputation, came here. His reverence, softness, humility, gentleness, and respect filled me with awe. I saw this man lie face down at Baba's feet, then later humbly approach him to sheepishly ask a question. Baba smiled, then went over to a basket containing packets of vibhuti and gave him a handful. The renowned scientist then turned and walked away with a smile reflecting the complete fulfillment. 10 p.m., May 27th. Dearest Sharon and family, it's late, I'm tired, have been up a long time. Today began at 3 o'clock in the morning. I participated in Nagara Sankirtan, a custom revived by Baba, which is becoming widespread in India. I walked with the male students barefoot at 5 a.m. through the streets of a nearby town, singing bhajans, devotional songs, repeating the names of the many different aspects or forms of God as he appeared to man throughout history. Baba says it is good to awaken to such holy vibrations as the singing of God's name, and it is quite impressive to see this band of men walking through town in such a spiritual and devotional attitude. But I'm very tired now and can hardly describe the activity further. Also, today for the very first time I saw energy pulsating from Baba's head, and I could clearly see his aura. This must be the halo described around an angel's head. What an experience. Love, Sam. 9 a.m., May 29th. Dear Sharon, yesterday was again hectic. Woke again at 3 a.m. so we could get to Baba's in time to sing in the streets. I've been feeling chronically weak and tired because of the schedule. An exciting thing happened, though. I'm becoming anxious because I've arranged to leave on the 31st and haven't had a personal interview with Baba yet. I began thinking that I wouldn't get this opportunity and have been asking people what I should do. Alf felt that because he was watching over me, it was his duty to ask Baba. When he did, Baba said that I would not leave on the 31st, but on the 1st. So I must run around now and change all my plane reservations. I guess this means that I should stay to see the ceremonies for the end of summer school, which will take place on the last day of the month. I'm also hopeful that he'll be seeing me. My spirits are lifted. Love, Sam. 12:45 a.m., June 2nd, sitting in an airplane awaiting takeoff from Bombay to New York. Dearest love, I'm awaiting takeoff for home, looking forward eagerly to seeing you and being with everyone. The past 2 days have been hectic and unusual. Delaying my departure to June 1st allowed me to see the ceremony for the end of the summer course. It was impressive and drove home the fact that Baba is vitally interested in education and that many top people in India are among his followers. Numerous high officials were present, with some speaking at the ceremony. I have also become aware that many people would like to see Baba, but few get in to visit with him intimately. I have advised a number of young Americans to visit him, and they came only to sit at the gate for long, hot hours, finally to leave discouraged. I have been extremely fortunate to be so close to Baba, and especially to have such a great guide and now close friend in Alf. Anyway, hoping to have a personal interview, I had been waiting expectantly, but Baba hardly gave me a glance. I went to the ashram early this morning before takeoff, and he didn't come downstairs to see me. To make a long story short, I haven't had a personal interview, and am leaving rather downhearted and hurt, but for a few strong exceptions. One, I know that Baba knows more than I do, and what I want might not be what I need. What he does shouldn't be questioned. Secondly, I have gotten all that I came for and more. He has awakened me to the existence of a higher reality and has convinced me of his greatness. His significance and meaning for me are very deep. He has given me a precious gift, and his not seeing me individually must be right. So here I am in a rather stuffy plane, awaiting takeoff and thinking always of you. Oops, the plane moves, and I must fasten my seatbelt. I'll see you soon. Love, Sam.